Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest annual call-in show, New Year's edition. No script or rigmarole of the usual kind for this episode. Joining me today is Julia Turner, the deputy managing editor of the LA Times. Hello, Julia. Season's greetings. Happy holidays.
Hello, hello. By the time our listeners hear this, we will be in the future, 2023.
I know, amazing, right? And of course, Dana Stevens is the film critic for Slate. Hey, Dana, you're always in the future. You live weeks, if not eons, ahead of the rest of the human race.
I begrudgingly beam back every week to talk to you, too.
Exactly, future woman Dana Stevens. Okay. So I have to say, just as by way of introduction, I think this is, along with the Strut, Summer Strut, my favorite episode of the year, certainly one of them. Should we get right to it? Just dig in, make a call-in show?
Let's roll.
Let's do it.
All right. Let's go to the first question. What do we got?
Hi, Culture Gabfest. This is Liz from Melbourne, New Jersey. And my question for each one of you is, what quotes from culture do you use in your everyday lives as a form of communication with others? Some favorites in our household, for example, are "Bob, it's time to engage" from The Incredibles and "You can't always get what you want" from The Rolling Stones. Thanks.
Ooh, okay. Who wants to nab this one first?
I've got a bunch, possibly because I'm married to someone who also works in culture. I don't know why. I think most of them actually come from my husband, but among the things we say are "too late, Liz Lemon," which was a line from something in 30 Rock. I don't even really remember what, but anytime anybody is too late for anything, or it's too late for anybody to tuck a final dirty dish in the dishwasher or get in on the scrambled egg order that's being whipped up, it's too late, Liz Lemon. The other one that we use all the time is a Simpsons reference, and we'll probably age out of this one, although maybe not now that we've got a new Bibbit in the house. But basically, anytime anybody spells anything out loud to avoid the comprehension of children, which obviously no longer works for our 9-year-olds, but you know, if you say like, "Oh, should we let them have candy or whatever?" We throw back to this immortal scene from The Simpsons, and maybe I'll just play it for you guys, so you can get the full effect. Hold on.
"I don't think we're talking about love here. We're talking about S-E-X in front of the C-H-I-L-D-R-E-N.
Sex cauldron? I thought they closed that place down."
So basically, anytime either of us tries to spell something to avoid comprehension by the children, the other one of us says, "Sex cauldron? I thought they closed that place down," in our best crusty voice. And then the children are like, "What's a sex cauldron?" So that one really is not. Sometimes I feel like you do these for efficiency in speech, or like efficiency of communication, but this one is inevitably inefficient because it results in the children being like, "What's that? What's sex? What are you talking about?"
Yeah, that really opens up a whole new cauldron of worms.
We can't resist it, though. We will never, nothing is ever spelled without us referring to that. There's another line from 30 Rock where one character says, "Here's what gives me pause." And then another character looks at them and says, "Those look like hands to me."
Oh my God, that is a groaner, but that's also a kind of, you know, go-to, you know, dad/mom joke, pop cultural reference. You need one groaner, and you definitely have one.
All right, I can definitely jump in here. I mean, I honestly feel like my family communicates 2/3 of the time in some version of quote from something, but often it's something that's just kind of passing through, something we've just recently seen, or, you know, a scene that my daughter's working on kind of catches fire and we start quoting it. But there are some also just old chestnuts that have been around for years. So to reference those, one of them, of course, is also from The Simpsons, which, you know, will, if nothing else, will live on forever as a quote machine for people to use in their everyday lives. And I think the primary one that we use from that, which has been sort of one of my mottos for a couple decades now, is a line from the famous and classic, I believe, sixth season episode of The Simpsons, A Star Is Burns, where Mr. Burns makes a movie about his own life called to Burns for All Seasons, directed by Senor Spielbergo, who's like the low-rent Spielberg that he's hired to direct his autobiographical movie. And in a famous line, right, everybody boos the movie because it's terrible. But then Hans Molman, one of my favorite minor Simpsons characters, who's the little wrinkle-faced guy who walks around town with a cane, says, I was saying boo Earns. Remember, because Mr. Burns insists that he's not being booed, that the crowd is yelling boo Earns. And then this one little guy in the corner actually was.
Smithies, are they booing me?
No, they're saying boo Earns. Boo Earns.
Are you saying boo or boo Earns?
I was saying boo Earns.
So somehow, whenever there's sort of like a wan moment that you're left out, or you're not participating in something, or you miss the joke, you know, you're Hans Molman in the corner saying boo Earns. So that one gets used a great deal, and it's usually me who's Hans Molman in that formulation because I missed out on a joke or something. Otherwise, I think our two most durable family movie quotes are probably from the same movie, Fantastic Mr. Fox, which is a huge, huge favorite in our family. I think we've talked about this on the show because I know Steve can't stand Wes Anderson or anything by him. I myself have a kind of mixed and complex relationship to him as a filmmaker where I find him both completely original and always interesting and also sometimes really annoying and mannered and stuck in a rut. But Fantastic Mr. Fox to me is one of his best films and is also just a children's classic that my daughter's loved since she was a little kid. So the two Fantastic Mr. Fox lines probably get brooded about the most are, well, this one's handy in many, many moments, I think, of domestic life. There's something that Mrs. Fox, voiced by Meryl Streep, says at a moment when she realizes that her husband, Mr. Fox, voiced by George Clooney, is up to no good, that he's stealing chickens with his boys again, and, you know, that he's slipping back into his old ways of thievery. And she says, it's all in Meryl Streep's delivery, but she says, if what I think is happening, it better not be. It's just such good delivery. And obviously, when you have a kid in the house, there is always something that you can say that about. So that one gets dusted off quite frequently. The other is just a random line that someone says, can't remember which character, in Fantastic Mr. Fox, because for one of Mr. Fox's elaborate schemes of how to go and steal chickens, he has to lure these beagles, these guard beagles, away from the place they're supposed to be guarding with blueberries. And there's just this moment, oh, it's Mr. Fox who says it, where he just shrugs in a very Clooney-esque, debonair fashion and says, beagles love blueberries. And somehow, whenever blueberries are brought out and served in any fashion, you have to shrug and say, beagles love blueberries. And the great coda to that is that after decades of saying beagles love blueberries on every occasion possible, my daughter, who's now 16, had a friend sleepover, a good friend from her school, high school, and they were feeding our dog blueberries at some point during the evening. And what did this girl say but beagles love blueberries? And I just did a double take and said, did you just say beagles love blueberries from Fantastic Mr. Fox? And that's when I realized that the two of them were meant to be soulmates.
Oh, my God. I love it. But my go-to Simpsons, like for some reason, it just stayed with me forever, is Homer has been left alone with the kids and he loses the baby. Of course, he's in a complete panic, not really because of the, you know, perhaps future total non-existence of his small child, but what Marge is going to do to him when she comes back. And I think it's because of some totally irresponsible behavior that he's engaged in with Barney, you know, the drunk down at Moe's and one of his friends. And, you know, Barney's just sort of hungover and half drunk as he always is. And Homer is desperately trying to rally him as his partner to go find the baby with all of that urgency of the parent with a lost child. And Barney says, well, you know, what if we make omelets first? And Homer's like, omelets? Are you crazy? Like, my kid is missing. And Barney says, are you sure? I make them with two cheeses.
Barney, I've lost a baby. It's the worst thing I've ever done.
Don't worry. You know what I'm going to do?
I'm gonna make you an omelet.
Just help me look.
Are you sure? I make them with two kinds of cheese.
Come on.
Wow.
I use that all the time when there's just some incredibly petty appetite that I want to satisfy, to which I'm willing to sacrifice all of the incredibly urgent life things that we as a family need to accomplish in the next like 5 freaking minutes. Are you sure I make them with two cheeses? And but the other one I really like, I love that both of these refer to my own prerogative, right? Which is, I would hope, out of character, but perhaps totally in character. But there's a great quote from King Lear that when I first came across it, I was surprised you don't hear all the time. Because what do, I mean, I understand that the neither the play nor the worldview of Shakespeare includes this psychology within it, but it's simply our modern bougie version of it, which is that you're constantly thinking about like what you deserve and don't deserve, and how the people have more than you don't deserve coincidentally exactly that proportion of what they have more than you have, and the people who have less have somehow reflect some transcendental deficit about them, or I don't know, it's just like this constant kind of inner dialogue about sort of like, well, what do I need and what do I not need? And of course, one of the central episodes of Lear is, you know, along the way to his realizing that without a throne, he's nothing. He's told that the number of troops, it's Regan or Goneril, is going to like vastly reduce the number of soldiers at Lear's disposal. And they're sort of like, well, what do you, and I think Regan or Goneril, or one of the son-in-laws, says in this dismissive way, like, well, why do you need 300 troops or whatever it is? And Lear just thunders back, oh, reason, not the need. And then he gives this kind of amazing mini soliloquy about, like, none of human life is reckoned in need. If we were reckoning in need, we'd be talking about, like, the tiniest, meagerest, most impoverished survivalist notion of human selfhood and identity. And it's, so it's, of course, I trot that one out and thunder like Lear the instant we're not making the omelet with the two cheeses. So I kind of do the, you know, it's like kind of like, you know, it's Simpson's shot Shakespeare chaser.
Do you, the two cheeses line seems very useful, but do you use it only for food situations, or is it like any time you want to do something mildly indulgent or indolent while pressing matters attend?
Latter. And it's just the Swiss Army knife of I'm just being an incredibly id-driven creep right now.
Okay.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on all your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
All right. Why don't we move on and listen to the next question?
Hi, this is Chris. My question is, there was an episode a while ago where Rick Steves, the travel guy, came up, and Dana said, I love Rick Steves, and then you all moved on. And I'm curious, what is your history with Rick Steves? Have you ever used one of his guides? Do you like him? What do you think about Rick Steves?
All right. This is a great example of a good listener question. Just picking some minuscule little throwaway line from a long ago show that we don't even remember. And now we really have to drill down on the Rick Steves question. I mean, I will say that I've never used one of his travel guides. My Rick Steves fandom is entirely based on his TV personality. I mean, I don't use travel guides in general, but I just like a good TV travel show. And Rick Steves really knows how to do that. You know, somebody who's really enthusiastic about the place they're visiting, knows a lot about it, and just, you know, takes you on a virtual tour that makes you want to go there. Like, Rick Steves can do that really well. Anthony Bourdain obviously could do that incredibly well in his various travel shows. And I think Stanley Tucci in that show we talked about, the CNN show that where he travels through Italy eating Italian food, does a similar thing. Just, I want some jolly dude to walk down an imaginary street in Europe with. Maybe Rick Steves has done stuff outside of Europe, but I'm really only familiar with his Europe travel stuff on TV. And yeah, I mean, I want to hear from Steve on this because he actually does travel for a living and write travel articles sometimes. But to me, what you want to virtually watch someone do on TV and how you yourself want to experience travel are completely different things. And to the extent I would use a travel guide, it would probably not be one that had a voice and a personality. It would be just the opposite. It would be the driest possible, here's a book of maps of Paris, you know, and you can find your own way through it. But in order to get inspiration for and energy and ideas about traveling, I love that kind of personality and voice-based show.
Oh, man. I mean, I guess the way I feel about Rick Steves is essentially how I feel about travel writing. And I don't think it's a stretch to say the moral ambivalences of doing it in an age of over-touristing and climate change, that getting in an airplane and flying is, you know, widely considered by scientists to be one of the very worst things you can do. And it's not just that you yourself are going on a trip to Tasmania, which is, I think, about as humanly far as you can go on planet Earth from New York City. It's certainly one of the furthest places. Okay, you've done that as an individual, that's fine. But putting it on the travel map, it's like I played my own small part in doing that. People generally didn't go to Tasmania as tourists unless they were themselves Australians, and they were kind of camp, like, this is what the Australians said, like camper van vacations, you know. In the 20 years since I read about it, it's become a big destination for all kinds of people. And that, believe me, that was a coincidence. I didn't make that happen in any way, but I played a role in making that happen. And it's like, there are people flying from all over the world to, you know, experience this locavore paradise, right? Because of all the wild variety of microclimates there, you can grow everything on this one island and beautifully. And it's like, yeah, like flying 17,000 miles to eat locally seems like a really screwed up way to try to square the circle of, you know, living ethically while satisfying your bourgeois appetites. And so, And then the second thing is, you know, the Valhalla, the magic of travel writing is to go someplace early in its cycle, like really early in its cycle. So, for example, Hobart, Tasmania, or, you know, it's like I can't go to a travel editor and say I want to write about Paris or London. I have to say I want to write about, you know, this, you know, museum you've never heard of in Paris that's actually the coolest one there. And it's, you know, if the Guardian wrote about it even as recently as 3 years ago, it's dead in the water for whoever I'm pitching. So there's this premium on discovery, right? At the same time, like, you could be initiating a cycle that just ends it. And, you know, you begin with this sweet little jewel of Europe that very few people go to, Barcelona, and it ends the most overrun, like, you know, clotted, sort of foreigner clotted city on the planet, with people putting cardboard signs in their windows saying go, like, basically go home. And so Rick Steves doing it incredibly well, and like being somewhat, I think, because he's approaching a much more, he's in a more mass medium, approaching a more mass audience, like, he's later in the cycle than I am, so it's just easy for me to go poo-poo him. But I'm just the first gentrifier, right? Like, I'm the villain at the beginning of the whole process. But that said, I also just have professional jealousy. Like, he's a star, he does it really well on TV, he finds interesting places, and he does it with, it seems to me, his heart in the right place and with good taste, right? So it's like, fuck him. Why don't I have that job?
You're tell a bitter, you really small feel, man, Steve. Peter. Steven, a small man.
Okay, but wait, I need you guys to explain the Rick Steves brand to me. Like, I feel like that, you know, it used to be that you could tell what stripe of person you were by which travel book you bought. Like, did you buy Frommer's and you were going to spend a gajillion dollars for dinner? Or did you buy Lonely Planet because you were kind of like eco and hostily? Or did you buy Let's Go because you like weirdly believed in the talents of Harvard College students and their, you know, hypothetical frugality and taste and judgment or whatever. Like, and Rick Steves is sort of, as someone who has her own very weird relationship with travel, journalism and travel writing, which we can get to in a minute, I like trying to think all of these as little as possible. Like, I really like to not know anything about where I'm going, mm-hmm. and then kind of,
yeah,
discover as though I just moved there. And so, but Rick Steves is kind of like, you want to spend you might want to splurge on one nice dinner. Like, you're not entirely hostile, but you're not entirely five star. And you want to be discerning. You have some disposable income. It's kind of like middle, right? Like, what's the actual brand, the Rick Steves brand?
I don't know. What would you say, Steve? I mean, he's on PBS, right? And public radio. That's generally how his radio and TV stuff is distributed. So it's to that audience, right? It's people that are educated,
right?
You know, probably middle class. Obviously, people that can afford to even think about doing things like touring Europe.
Right, but not with ostentation or luxury at its core, and kind of, I would say, as befitting those, you know, PBS and NPR, sort of upper middle brow with a kind of like sort of all American guy, you know, thing to it that makes him relatable to a pretty, you know, a pretty wide audience.
Yeah. And I feel like he's a guy whose heart is in the right place. You know, he, speaking of the environment, is known for, you know, talking a lot about trying to incorporate carbon neutrality into your travel as possible. He donates to environmental causes. He was very anti-Trump during the Trump administration, which I appreciated. He didn't have to go out on that limb at all. I don't know. To me, he just has a good guy feeling. He's somebody who, if you bumped into him at your hostel in Amsterdam, you would really enjoy your evening chatting with Rick Steves.
I mean, so I think the question I have is sort of whether people use these books anymore. Like, I remember going to the Greek islands one summer when I was backpacking in Europe and doing everything on like $7 a day. And I remember getting to like Mykonos, I think, and it just looked like a Parliament ad. And I felt so disappointed that this thing I was seeing was something I had already seen so many images of. And it felt like I was like checking off this visual expectation box in my mind. And ever since then, I like toss the travel section out the window. Like, I do not seek like visual inspiration for where I'm going to go, because I don't like the idea of going to confirm what I've seen photographically. I kind of like try to tuck verbal descriptions of places in my mind or what I know of their history in my desire to, you know, as I sort of stack up desires to go see places. And one place like that in particular is Rio. I've never been to Brazil. I'd love to go to Rio. Rio seems like one of those just jaw-dropping cities to behold from, you know, you can't avoid it if you're as much of a fan of the Fast Furious movies as I am. But, you know, so I have images of Rio have crossed my eyeballs, but I like try to avert my eyes. Like, truly, if you see Rio, I like look away because I want to go there someday and I want to be sort of surprised by it. And I like to kind of just go and stay somewhere and see what the interesting breakfast place is nearby. And I'm lucky to travel with my husband and others who plan and do and read. But I have a weird aversion to information about travel, which is sort of dumb, but true. Other than I do use those New York Times 36 hours guides. I find them to be like the right amount of information, lightly orienting, a couple recs, don't have to even follow them, but it gives you a general lay of the land of like, these are the six neighborhoods you should be thinking about. These are the four types of activities that people do here. So I do use those.
I have one thing to say about Rio, Julia, which is that if and when you do make it down there, please let me be one of your travel guides and I will give you some ideas. I mean, I haven't been there in more than 20 years, but I spent two summers living in Rio, and really, topographically, I guess would be the word, geographically, it's the most beautiful city I've ever been in. Just the way the landscape interacts with the city and the suddenness with which these huge hills come bursting out of the city. It is a little like San Francisco in that way, but, you know, just a much more spectacular and more saliently topographically diverse kind of space than San Francisco. Just a wonderful city.
All right. Have we done it justice?
I think so.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son, George, on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. Trust me, you've never seen a mother-son duo like this before. This show is full of wit, scandal, action, And did I mention Julianne Moore? Something this audacious and sexy is as genre-bending as it gets. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Stars and the Stars app.
Okay, next up we have a listener question that came in by email from Harry McLean, who writes, I'm a longtime listener and fan living in the UNESCO City of Literature, Melbourne, Australia. I would love for you to talk about what your favorite books about films are and give you a chance to plug your own. All right, Dana, I think this is a fat, slow pitch down the middle to you. So why don't you start?
Well, I mean, this whole year has been one long chance to plug my own. So I'll start with that one and get out of the way. I'm not at all saying that this is one of the most important film books to read. But since you asked, I have a brand new book, well, this year, about Buster Keaton called Cameraman that is in stores now and coming out in paperback next year. And in the course of researching this book over the last 6 years, I read lots and lots of great books about film. So let me think of a few that I can recommend. I mean, I guess it depends on what you're looking for, but just a very basic film history that is extremely well written by two great film scholars who are also beautiful writers is called Film History and Introduction. It's a really common text in film classes in college and things like that, by Kristen Thompson and David Bordwell. David Bordwell, the latter of the two authors, also has a really great blog where he just writes about, you know, old film and films of the day. And he's just, he's sort of a graphomaniac. I mean, the guy just writes an unbelievable amount and it's always interesting and good. So that's my general tome recommendation. And then here are a couple of books that I often give to young people who are interested in film, who are graduating from film school or the like. There's a really beautiful book called The Conversations. I think we've maybe talked about it before on the show, that is a series of conversations about film between two friends who also work in film and literature. Walter Murch, the great editor who edited, oh my Lord, I mean, The Conversation, I think The Godfather movies, all three of them, a talented Mr. Ripley, Apocalypse Now, just one of the great editors and collaborators in the history of American film, is friends with Michael Ondaatje, the novelist who wrote the novel that English Patient is based on, a movie Murch edited. So the two of them met on the set of The English Patient and started this series of conversations about film and culture, and eventually these were collected into a book. It's really unusual and beautiful. The Conversations, I recommend really highly. Sidney Lumet has a book called Making Movies, so it's movies from the point of view of a director, and it's one of the best books about, you know, the experience of bringing together the logistical hell that is a movie shoot and some of his experiences doing that. And movie criticism. This will be my last one. There's a collection called American Movie Critics, collected by Philip Lopate, the great essayist. And he just has a wonderful taste and a great eye and knows a lot about the history of film criticism. So going all the way back to the silent era, he just picks some great movie reviews and writing on film through the decades, going all the way up to, you know, A.O. Scott is one of the last people collected in that book. So those are some different angles, I guess, depending whether you want, you know, film history, behind the scenes gossip, or history of criticism.
Oh, wow. Those are fabulous. I had a David Bordwell book on mine on the history of film style, which is more of the same. I mean, he's just a utterly lucid, approachable, stylistically approachable film academic who's really, he's just the great, to my mind, dean of academic film history, scholarly film history. All right, so to that I'd add, sort of going down the waterfront here, a work of a sort of first-person memoir about the monster of the film business. Of course, Final Cut by Stephen Bach, about disastrous making of Heaven's Gate at the time, reputed to be the largest financial disaster. It sunk United Artists, a legendary film company that had been around for whatever it was, 60, 50 years. It's just an amazing book. The writing of it, the grace of it, Bach's voice is wonderful. His light touch, his sense of irony and culpability. I mean, he greenlit the movie and went down with it. But that's just a wonderful, wonderful book. And then as a work of criticism, you know, it's a funny choice in a way, and a lot of people would object to it. But sort of before Pauline Kael became Pauline Kael, the titanic, you know, presence at the New Yorker for, you know, the whatever it was, 10 or 15 golden years of the auteur in American Hollywood filmmaking. You know, she was a veteran. She'd been around for a while before she got the job and doing extraordinary work. And it had wonderful, that same wonderful confidence to it and verve in a way, but it was she was writing for unexpected outlets out of a passion, and it came less from on high before she got to the New Yorker. Let me put it that way. So I Lost It at the Movies is actually a wonderful book to read because it brings you back to Cale. You know, it's just some of the essays in that, they're exemplary works of criticism for their captivating intelligence and sense of style and wit in their own right, and a person conveying their own passions while also writing a fairly, you know, rigorous style of criticism. And then one more in novel, What Makes Sammy Run, because at the heart of Hollywood, I think, is a contradiction, if I'm not totally wrong, which is that nothing happens without the writer. And the writer is somehow always at the very bottom of the totem pole in the movie business. But, you know, the writer is sort of often the butt of jokes in Hollywood, or at least it was traditionally. It may not be anymore. Maybe, you know, he or she or they are exalted. But anyway, and it gets at this weird contradiction of because it's told from the point of view of it's a novel, but I mean, the writer in it it's the novel's written by Bud Schulberg, you know, and so it's obviously based partially on his experience, and he's a screenwriter in it, and he lives in this contradiction that the movie business is just, he's on, you know, it's back in the old day of the old studio system. He's actually on the lot producing copy on crazy deadline. And there's this, he perceives as a social type now in extremis, Sammy Glick, who's the essence of a completely empty, self-promoting human being. And it's obviously an enduring social type in American history, as we just had one as president. But it's got a special sort of resonance, or horrible void-like lack of resonance in Hollywood, right? The person who's just somehow attracted to that form of megalomania and is only self-promoting, but sort of has to pretend they're about making good movies or making movies good in order to feed their own egomania. And it's the relationship between this writer, who's sort of a traditional author, I mean, he's producing this novel that you're reading, pitted against this kind of anti-author, you know, who's using him in some way. And it just, I don't know, that book, when I finally read it, I thought it just tells a lasting truth about the movies.
I think part of what this segment is teaching me is that I barely ever read books about movies. I don't have quite as long a list of recommendations for you guys, but I did think of a few, a couple of which we've discussed or I've mentioned on the show recently. I do think that our friend Mark Harris's Mike Nichols biography is just an amazing, amazing read and sort of a portrait of the evolution of American culture. It's about theater and film and about ambition. But it's also just really well made as a thing to read, whether or not you count yourselves among people who read film books. I also endorsed earlier this year The Mirage Factory, which is a portrait of early Los Angeles, that's sort of a triple portrait of Amy Semple McPherson's kind of religious group, the kind of original water sins underlying Los Angeles as a location, and the dawn of the movie business. So it's not quite a film book, but it's a good sort of civic look at the origins of film here and how Los Angeles came to be and part of its character. And then I will say, I do have Nobody's Perfect, which is a collection of Anthony Lane's criticism, largely film criticism, although it also includes a bunch of his book criticism as well. And I think sort of the fashionable line on Anthony Lane is that he's a great writer of sentences who maybe should have been a book critic, because he's better at writing sentences than in making sense of films. Maybe that's unfair. I feel like that's what like true film heads think of him. Dana, I won't put you on the spot. I haven't read that book in years. I'm not even sure where it is right now. But I remember as a young writer, you know, sometimes you read things that you can't pull off in order to whet your ambition. And I remember sometimes if I had a piece to write, I would go read a few of his reviews to just sort of instigate in myself sort of a fury that I couldn't write sentences that sharp, but that I'd better try. And I do think, just in terms of every single clause, line, bit of punctuation being intended to sparkle your nervous system and entertain you and make you think and prod you. It's very active prose. It's very energetic prose. It's very tart prose. So I did have that relationship with that book at one time. I have not gone back to read it in years. I wonder what I would think of his criticism now that I'm older and wiser. But I got to go get myself a copy of that book.
He's quite a stylist. The line that I always think of with Anthony Lane is something that he wrote about, I think it was the Phantom of the Opera movie. It's just one phrase, but he says, watching this movie is like being asphyxiated by brocade. It's just so good. And that's the kind of thing he's good at, just, you know, the mot juste right when you need it.
Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Okay, let's move on to another voicemail.
So there is currently a Tana French-sized hole in my heart as I am desperately waiting for a new book to be announced. I would love any more cozy mysteries or favorite genre recommendations.
I feel like I need to take this one since I'm the biggest genre reader among us, which is why I have such a lack of erudite recommendations about film, probably. I, too, have a Tana French-sized hole in my reading list. She remains my absolute favorite combiner of actually good writing, real psychological acuity, and pretty damn good thrillers that honestly actually are a little bit of anthropological travel writing as well, with her kind of expat perspective on Ireland. But a couple other series, none of which is quite as good, but which have filled the plot, please give me plot, but also make it readable hole in my reading list. One are the books of Ruth Ware. These are a little bit schlockier. She's being pitched by her publisher as sort of a modern day Agatha Christie, and they do have that quality of being sort of potboilery, and the characterizations are a little bit more pat and thin than Tana French. But wow, these are the books that have kept me up at night. Like once you get 60% through, it's like a long slide, like stay up till 4 a.m, can't stop turning the pages. They're very good. The best one is One by One, which is about a corporate retreat that takes place in a Swiss chalet, and then there's an avalanche, and it's basically 10 little Indians, but quite excellent. And then finally, I'm on like a months-long Michael Connelly tear. And, you know, Michael Connelly writes detective novels set in Los Angeles. I read a few of the very first ones when I first got here, and I think I didn't know quite enough about Los Angeles yet to catch all of his references. And I also think his early books were not as good. They were like a little bit macho and a little bit, they weren't that interesting. But I've been reading lately the most recent, I don't know, basically everything he's written since 2013 forward. I happened to pick up a book from 2013 and really liked it, so I just kind of kept going forward. And I've been really impressed with him kind of having the opposite of the like famous successful author gets too big to edit and keeps phoning in the same thing over and over again. Like each book is really structured around a different idea, absorbs the way the world is changing, introduces new characters that reflect the diversity of LA, tries to do that with sensitivity. Even just sort of what each book is about. There's a book where a senior detective is sort of teaching young detectives how to do their job. Then there's a book that's about the tension between doing investigative work as a defense you know, as a detective, essentially for prosecutions and doing detective work on behalf of defense lawyers. Like they're I don't know, they're just much more varied and interesting and complicated than they need to be given how successful he is. And I really admire that.
Those are great. I want to make that list. I need more of this in my life. I mean, I have become a huge admirer of Ian Rankin, but I wouldn't call his cozy, they're the opposite of cozy. I mean, his mysteries that take place in Edinburgh and feature this sort of very tough, you know, jaded detective are beautifully written and very well, very finely observed studies of the sociology of modern day Edinburgh, as well as being good, interesting mysteries, but they're not cozy at all. They're not they're sort of anti drawing room, if anything. But the more it's been a little while now, like maybe 10 years, but the very first novel by Eric Ambler that and many people point to as the origin of the modern spy novel, Epitaph for a Spy, has a kind of it's, if I had to guess, was probably written in the 30s or 40s, 30s would be my guess, but it has a drawing room quality to it, a sort of old world drawing room quality of, yes, the stakes are large world, you know, sort of geopolitical in some heavily implied sense, but it takes place in a very insular, small European microcosm, as I recall. And so the sort of politics of the small and the politics of the large come together in this super suspenseful way. That is an amazing book. It's short, deft, and really one of the better works of genre fiction I've ever read. And I think it scratches the cozy itch.
I'm making notes as you all talk. I think I have the least to contribute in this category because I really don't read genre fiction that often. And certainly if I am drawn to a detective novel or something that would fall under the aegis of genre fiction, it's not cozy. My favorite detective novels and things in that genre are the really dark ones. And Raymond Chandler is somebody I once went on a big tear of reading essentially everything. I mean, everything by Raymond Chandler is extraordinary. And just his virtuosity as a writer is unbelievable. But that's not cozy. And then another genre novel that I love from, you know, similarly from mid-century America is, and I wonder if either of you know this, Night Has a Thousand Eyes by Cornell Woolrich. Have either of you read that? Extremely dark and uncozy book. It is really, I mean, just existentially bleak beyond belief, but gorgeously written. And the premise of it is this interesting mix of almost crime and fantasy. It's about a detective and who was trying to solve a mystery that involves a con man who's clairvoyant. And so part of the question of the book is, you know, is he conning people or can he actually see the future? And the detective himself kind of gets drawn into this question, right? Is there not a supernatural power, you know, element to the crime he's trying to solve? It's incredible. It's super page turner and gorgeously written. But because those are so uncozy and those are really going to suspend you over the brink of despair, I have to throw in just an extremely, extremely cozy genre writer who doesn't really write mysteries. And that's P.G. Wodehouse. You can't go wrong if you're going to go on a kick of P.G. Wodehouse reading. And it's extremely, it takes place in what I consider one of the most pleasingly kind of conflict-free worlds in literature. So the conflicts in P.G. Wodehouse novels are always something about, you know, is Duchess so-and-so going to come to the tea party? And what on earth shall happen if, you know, the engagement is broken between Sir such-and-such and his lady? And they're very silly. But they're extremely funny and they're sort of addictive. Once you start on P.G. Wodehouse, you can't stop till you've read a whole bunch.
Yeah, that's a really good suggestion. I guess I should also stipulate that none of my recs are particularly cozy either. Like and honestly, a ton of French isn't very cozy. What's cozy is you're not there in the book being murdered or being threatened with murder. Like, that's what makes reading mysteries cozy is, like, you're like, I'm in my bed under my comforter not being murdered. Like, that's the contrast rather than the actual book.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, Leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Okay, I think our next one is an email. So, Dana, maybe you'd read it for us.
Yeah, this is a great question. It's a bit long, so stick with me through it. But you need a little of the background to get to the question. This is a question from a listener named Chris, and he says, I play the violin with orchestras and ballet and opera companies in Philadelphia and Denver, and was well and truly excited to see Tar, but found it nearly unwatchable because of how much it got wrong about the classical music world. And he goes on to enumerate some of the inaccuracies. He then says, my question is, does this kind of veracity matter at all? Did I enjoy Black Swan because I'm not a ballet dancer, or Spotlight because I'm not a journalist? Are there movies that bother you because they get the details wrong, even though getting them right would make the plot less interesting?
I mean, I will say that I grew up in part in the Boston Globe newsroom, or at least visiting it really regularly. My parents met in the Boston Globe cafeteria. They were both Globe journalists until I was probably in fifth or sixth grade, and when my mom moved on. And Spotlight's commitment to reproducing that office was bananas, like bananas. Like there was a little break room where they have cake at some point, and it's like I was in that break room where they used to keep little teeny tiny cartons of chocolate milk, which was like why you were excited to go visit my parents at the office is because of the teeny tiny cartons of chocolate milk. So it was delightful to see, kind of like seeing a dollhouse of your childhood or something. Did it make the movie better? I don't know. Like, it's uncanny when they get it right. And I think more broadly, that movie got a lot right about journalistic process, about the tenacity required of investigative journalism, about how investigative journalism has evolved in the last 25 years in terms of who it listens to and whose stories it tries to tell, about the kinds of pressures that can be exerted upon investigative journalists and the kind of toll that's taken on investigative journalists when they're pursuing that kind of story. Like, the accuracy helped. It might have been distracting for me if it weren't accurate. I'm not sure the accuracy is what made that movie good. And similarly, we got into a debate with Jamel when we talked about She Said a few weeks ago, in which he argued that it would have been nice for balance if Carey Mulligan's character had done some more of the reporting trips in the, you know, second third of the movie when it gets a little bit more heavily weighted towards the Jodi Kantor character. And, you know, I counter-argued that the point there is to show working women, because the whole story is about the effect of sexual harassment on working women and what it means to be a working woman. And the reason that Jodi Kantor did that reporting is because Carey Mulligan had an infant at home. And yet, despite being unable to go to Wales, she was crucial to getting the story. And so anyway, I think whether it matters depends on what kind of story you're trying to tell. But I'm very curious what you two think of this.
I have to say, this is like one of those hobby horses I've ridden so often over the course of the GabFest. I hope people don't tune out what I'm about to say, but let me come at it from a slightly different angle, which is, you know, In Cold Blood is a mind-blowingly good book. It made Truman Capote deservedly a superstar, a literary superstar. It's also substantially falsified and not true, right? And it's large, important parts of it. I mean, much of it is reported and totally true. I mean, but it was called, I believe it was called the first nonfiction novel, and it was sold as a work of nonfiction. But novel only meant that can you believe this true story conforms so beautifully to the conventions of a novel and delivers the kind of narrative satisfactions of a work of fiction. And also just the texture of the writing and the literary ambition of the writing. It was something new. And actually, I think it's very worthwhile reading. But if you were, for example, teaching it, as I think you should, to a long-form journalism class, you would then engage with the ethical question of the manifest untruths in the book and compare what he did and how he did it with what we now know to actually have happened, right? And then I think there's just a larger philosophical question of, like, why do you care? And I think it has to be this, that there's... let's say you're a historian or a journalist working for a notoriously scrupulous, you know, ethically scrupulous outfit like the New Yorker or the Times, which does really make a good faith effort to factually verify everything you say. And using a set of facts that actually happened, you managed to produce what Capote produced, or a facsimile of it, which is a beautifully told narrative. You've done something with consummate skill while telling the reader the truth. And what the reader gets on the other side of that transaction is factual enlightenment, which they're grateful for, and they get the genre thrill. And that's like a split in bowling, right? Like, you've done something extraordinary and given them something extraordinary. If the veracity isn't there, you've actually falsified their experience of what you've written, not just the factual record of it, right, behind it, underlying it. And I think that that's where the ripoff happens, right? It's not just that you're cheating history, right, which I think is important, but you've really cheated the reader. And so the reason it's become a hobby horse that I ride is we see based on a true story, based on a true story, based on a true story, it's appended to a third of what we watch now. And there are certain things that it's also a funny thing, because one of my favorite pieces of TV, and Julia, I know you agree, of the last like 10 years was Amanda Seyfried and the Dropout, which is based on a true story. And there was something about the manifest TV-ness of it and the kind of deliciousness of it that made me understand I wasn't watching a purely factual, and it was just, you know, how much did it deviate? If it deviated totally and I was watching a work of nonfiction, it just would have lacked its power, right? So it's just, I guess I don't, Dana, have a clear, bright line answer to this question, but veracity somehow is very important to me, and it damages my ability to enjoy things that are purportedly, you know, quote unquote, based on a true story.
Yeah, I think to me it has to do with trusting the filmmaker or the showrunner, actors. I mean, it's trusting the cast and crew and team of people that are bringing you the story to have done the work on their end, which doesn't necessarily mean they're replicating moment for moment everything that happened. Obviously, there's condensation in a story like The Dropout, right? I mean, events that happened over a period of years are condensed into a shorter time, or maybe there's a composite character who didn't really exist in real life, and that's part of being able to turn this into a narrative that is, you know, has a beginning, middle, and end, and a shape to it. But you have to trust that in the process of doing that shaping, a lot of serious work was put into thinking about the world they're showing you. And that's where what I would say in defense of Tar, as someone who's not from the classical music world, made it effective for me, is that I felt that Todd Field and Cate Blanchett and all the people that worked on that film had thought through very carefully what the rules of their world was going to be. You know, so there may be, for example, I didn't read those parts of the email, but there may be elements in the audition scene that are not really how an orchestra audition would go, right? And maybe that's going to bug you if you're somebody from that world. But I felt like I learned so much about the ethics and just the milieu of classical music from learning that movie that I trust, you know, and I suppose I could watch it with this listener and he would tell me not to trust those things. But I placed my faith in the filmmaker to have done his work to introduce me into that world, if that makes sense. And I mean, then there are times, as in She Said, maybe, you know, have more veracity to it than Spotlight. I think it's a less good movie. I wasn't here on the show the week that you talked about She Said, but to me, the failure of that movie is that it doesn't quite understand the narrative part of things. You know, maybe it needed a bit more fictionalization. There was a hell of a lot of talking on the phone and driving around in cars to go meet sources and things that no doubt happen when you're a shoe leather reporter trying to investigate a story, but that don't necessarily make for the greatest cinema.
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer for In Cold Blood and the answer for Tar are opposite ends of the spectrum, right? Like, if you are presenting what you're doing as journalism and as a reporting of the facts, the obligation to be absolutely authentic, to me, gets higher the more your narrative chops are. You know, I mean, we've talked a bunch about my just delight and mesmerization at Patrick Radden-Keefe's Empire of Pain book, which is an incredible work of investigative journalism that is an absolute potboiler to read. And one of the things that makes it so extraordinary is you just trust the rigor of the facts underlying it all. And that's what makes the fact that it does kind of resolve itself into this incredible family narrative all the more impressive and incredible to behold. With Tar's sort of the other end of the spectrum, because Tar isn't a movie about the classical music world. It's a movie that's using the classical music world to say something that I honestly don't totally still understand about power, art, ego. It could have been a movie about ballet. It could have been a movie about race car driving. Like, it doesn't matter that it's a classical music movie. And so the bits and bobs about the audition scene feel immaterial to me. The part in the middle is this sort of like using true life stories for IP. So Spotlight, She Said, The Dropout, the Amanda Seyfried version of Elizabeth Holmes' story, those are all kind of in the middle, right? Like, and if you think of Spotlight and She Said as sort of two movies, in part because they're about journalism, probably feel an even deeper obligation to be factual than not. Those honestly both, even though I like both movies and agree that Spotlight is a far better film, they're both kind of dramatizations. And the thing I liked about She Said is that it's making an argument about why it matters for women not to get harassed in the workplace, and like what women are capable of in the workplace when their sexuality and reproductive freedoms are respected. But The Dropout is a little bit closer. It's sort of using the story of Elizabeth Holmes to tell a narrative about, again, ambition, power. Like it feels closer. So I think to me, in fiction, in sort of creative works that are not journalism, which I don't think She Said or The Dropout are, how much authenticity matters depends on what the heck the thing is trying to do.
Yeah, beautifully done. I agree.
Okay, should we go for our last question?
Yeah, let's do it.
Hi, Slate Culture Gabfest. This is Laura calling from Los Angeles. I'm a huge fan. This year, we've seen several movies where filmmakers have mined their own childhoods to put art on screen. I'm thinking of The Fablemans and Steven Spielberg, Armageddon Time from James Gray, even recently Alfonso Cuarón's Roma or Greta Gerwig's Lady Bird, which got me thinking. So my question to you guys is, if there was going to be a film made about your childhood, what is a scene you would absolutely have to include? And just an FYI, if there were films made about all of your childhoods, I would be first in line to see them. Thanks so much and have a great holiday. Bye, guys.
Ooh, oh, I love that question. That is so interesting. It's also one of those questions that, in total bad faith, I want to hear your answers desperately, but don't want to offer my own. So, in that spirit, Julia Turner,
I definitely have one answer here that I'm not sharing with you or anybody, but two things that came to mind. I mean, for one thing, I do not intend to ever write a memoir. I don't want to write a book. I don't want to make a movie. Like, I don't think I want to tell the story of my life in any form, fiction or none. I did actually just write for the first time, maybe ever, definitely in a long time. I wrote like a memoiristic essay for the LA Times. I wrote about tension in my family over this German potato ball recipe that my sister and I insist must be made every Thanksgiving. So I actually literally just turned the stuff of my life into a public piece. It's on the LA Times site. You should go check it out. We'll put a link on the show page. So that was a new mode. It was pleasurable. It did not make me want to do more of this. But there are two scenes that would make for drama in a movie about my life. One is, my family never really traveled for tourism as kids. We visited family. Any vacation, we either visited my grandmother in Santa Mariches, we visited my grandparents in Connecticut, or when they retired to Florida. the number of trips we took that were not to either of those destinations or just renting this one beach place in Massachusetts near us, like, we took vacations, but we didn't do tourism, maybe is the way to say it. But the one exception to that, which I think was very foundational for me, is we and another family that we grew up with rented a kind of ramshackle house in Tuscany for 3 weeks the summer between fifth and sixth grade. And it was this real kind of exception to the, it was my only time going out of the country before college. It was just a real exception to how we conducted ourselves otherwise. And it was amazing. We cooked, we ate, we drove around to different little Tuscan towns. We went to Florence. We, you know, we rented a car randomly that turned out to be a Lancia, which my dad had a lot of fun driving around curvy roads. There were pine nut trees outside, and we would sort of crack the pine nuts out of their casings, and I just have all these memories of it. I went on to study Italian as the first modern foreign language I studied after I learned Latin. I went back to Italy. I still think maybe I would take every vacation in Italy forever, except for all the other places I want to go. Like, super, super formative experience because it was so unusual in my childhood. But I remember getting there the first night, and, you know, we'd rented this place sort of sight unseen with whatever information was available in 1989. And we got there, and there were sort of these, like, grungy 70s corduroy sofas with cigarette burns all over them. And there were these huge, horrifying caterpillars, like, crawling all over the walls. And we'd been on this very, very long journey. We'd flown through, I don't know, some other European city, and then we rented the car, and then we drove for hours. So we were all exhausted. And I remember I was, like, 10, and my mom was so disappointed. Like, she just wept, and she was really, you know, just like, it was not their, you know, they clearly, like, saved up to do this one special trip, and then the thought of spending weeks in this, like, place that was so depressing in its interiors upon first aspect exhausted, she just, like, kind of had a little meltdown. And I remember being 11 and being feeling like the mature one for the first time and being like, it's going to be okay. We're in this cool place. We'll move the caterpillars outside. We'll put a sheet over the like, it was one of the first memories I have of, like, consoling her and telling her it was going to be all right. And I just, you know, it's like that first memory of being the grown-up in the relationship with your grown-up. So that's one.
Oh, that was very cinematic. I can easily see that in a movie. The moldy couch and the caterpillars and the crying mom. It's a great, it's a very illustrative scene, as told. I wish I had something good. The listener who left a voicemail left, and we didn't play this, left as her example that she remembers the Northridge earthquake in California in 1994, I think it was, when she was a small child, and it's one of her earliest memories. I wish I had something that dramatic, an event that mattered to the world that I could remember being part of. But the thing that occurred to me that was just a sort of illustrative story of who I was as a kid is extremely domestic and dull kind of moment, but it's become a funny story in my family. And I think it's a good character establishing moment, if nothing else, which is that when we were little, my mother used to occasionally get these pastries, these delicious pastries from H-E-B, which is a sort of fancy grocery store chain in San Antonio. And once in a while, when we got home from school, she would still be at work, but she would have left these pastries on the counter for us. We called them chocolate goops, and they were delicious. They were sort of like this coffee flavored custard inside of a puff pastry with chocolate on the outside. And so it was this rare treat when we would have chocolate goops waiting for us when we got home from school. But it was, as it turned out years later, not as rare as I thought it was growing up, because apparently my brother and sister habitually, when they were sitting on the counter when we got home from school, would split the third one and not tell me they were there at all, because I was always in my room reading. So because I was reliably daydreaming off in a book somewhere and not available, they would just spot them on the counter, share the third one, throw away the wrappers, and never tell me they were there. And I don't think this news was broken to me until, you know, we were in our 20s and no longer in the position to ever have chocolate goops again. So thanks a lot, bro and sis. But I think that's, I mean, that's an autobiographical moment simply because it establishes, you know, what I was doing so much of the time in my childhood and how much that sort of took me out of, made me oblivious to the events around me.
Love that.
That Steve, is so what have you good. Got? Okay, let me go with this one. So, intertitle, 1972, let's say. It's 1971. And a little boy is being dressed by his mother in a preposterous little outfit, a little sailor suit, and all the little cutesy overthought details of it being put into absolutely perfect place. And then they go and they join the father, typical sort of 50s style, though we're in the 1970s, you know, breadwinner dad, sort of very, very, very proper, turned out homemaker mom, and an older sister in her little Sunday best dress. And then they walk down together, take an elevator down in the apartment building, walk down Park Avenue together and go to the Presbyterian church right on Park Avenue, sit in a pew and sing a hymn, when the little boy looks over and sees the girl from his Sunday school class, Vicky Chandler, looking over at him. And the little spark in her eye sparks something in his eye. And later that morning at some sort of Sunday school like gathering, Vicky Chandler convinces him that he's been invited to her house for after Sunday school and to come and play, and that everyone's given the proper permissions. And so he goes with Vicky Chandler back to her house, and together they put a blanket over the dining room table and play underneath the table. And it's this enormously liberating experience for the boy in the sailor suit to escape from the clutches of Park Avenue and into this far looser, more semi-bohemian household where you can actually construct such things as tents in the out of the dining room table and a blanket, only to discover later that Vicky Chandler had been lying all along and his parents are in a panic and have dialed. There wasn't 911 back then, I don't think. Or maybe there was. Was there 911 back in 71? Whatever. And are totally freaking out about their missing child. And it turns out I was kidnapped by Vicky Chandler. hence igniting the essential dialectic of my life, which is this preposterously uptight, spoiled child of the white upper middle class, mid-century upper middle class, desperately looking for escape, but in the end, victim only to total passivity at the hands of other women. No. Got that.
Liberated by the cleverness of other women.
Yes, there you go. Exactly. Beguiled by the promise and the cleverness of other women. Anyway, something like that.
Oh my gosh. These are all very cinematic. It's funny because they're scenes. They're not plot. Like the one I abandoned is when I was the editor of the weekly newspaper in my high school, there was a kid in one of the dorms who dropped acid and went on a rampage with a knife. And, you know, our reporters, like, figured out what happened and who it was. And we had the story. And we had to negotiate with the principal about whether we were going to publish the kid's name or not. We were technically not the school paper. We were, like, independently funded, so they couldn't. It wasn't, they didn't actually have the authority to control what we published. And also that principal was my best friend's mom, but we had like a lot of long wrestling sessions in her office. So that was plot, but not really seen in quite the same way.
All right, well, that's it for our call-in show for this New Year's. I want to give a very, very warm and sincere thank you to everyone who sent in a question, either via email or voicemail or social media, however you did it. We really appreciate it. Without them, as with Strut, it's user-generated content, which we just get to bounce off of. But thank you very much for that.
Can I note something else about the questions that we got, Steve? Mm-hmm. Just that if your question didn't get answered, it's going into our pile for future Slate Plus questions. So keep on listening. It's very likely that looking for listener questions, we will at some point dig into that archive and answer a few.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, of course, as always, thanks. Thanks, Julia.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Dana.
It was fun, Steve.
Yeah, very fun. You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page. That's slate.com/culturefest. And you can email us at culturefest@slate.com. Our introductory music is by the composer Nick Bertel. Our production assistant is Jessica Balderrama. Our producer is Cameron Drews. For Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. We will see you soon.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.